Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this podcast early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. In the last few episodes of this show, we've kept the focus on the barbarians. Specifically, we've followed the Goths as they moved from beyond the frontiers of the Roman Empire to the Balkans, and then to the sack of Rome itself in 410 AD. We've striven to see events from their perspective, to understand why they acted as they did, and to understand the complex relationship that existed between the empire and the barbarians on both sides of the frontier. Now, I took that perspective because, far too often, the barbarians play into the story of the fall of the Roman Empire merely as the agents of chaos. Either they were the destructive force that toppled an otherwise healthy state, or merely the tipping point that the diseased, rotten corpse of a once great empire needed to slip over the edge into full putrescence. But the barbarians weren't an abstract force whose function was to move the world from one stage of history to another. They were people, real people, who had hopes and dreams and aspirations, who came from distinct cultures and societies, and who lived real lives. That's what I wanted to focus on in the beginning. Now that we've done that, though, we can come back to the Roman Empire itself. Specifically, there's one question that we need to address. Just how messed up was the later Roman Empire, anyway? In today's episode, we'll take a broad, bird's-eye view of the empire as it existed in the 4th century, between the Goths' crossing of the Danube and their slow-motion rebellion. We'll discuss the economy, the relationship between the various cities and localities that made up the empire and its central government, the army, and most importantly, how the emperor and the state functioned. We're going to discuss how the empire changed from its glory days in the 1st and 2nd century, and why the 3rd century was such a disaster. Most of all, we're going to try to evaluate whether the empire was basically healthy or an intrinsically flawed state. This is a way of getting at the question of causality, of why the empire fell, something we addressed in broad outlines in the introduction to this show. Were the barbarians merely the straw that broke the camel's back of a creaking, rotten state? Or did the barbarians destroy a well-run, functional empire through repeated, violent incursions? If you've been listening to the last few episodes, you can probably guess that I think that the paradigm of barbarians as destructive invaders isn't a real productive way of looking at the relationship between the empire and the people who lived beyond its borders. With that said, there's no real question that their consistent, low-level raiding and occasional mass invasions did put legitimate stresses on the ability of the Roman state to manage its frontiers and its armies, and we should take that possibility seriously. But this episode isn't about the barbarians. It's about Rome. So let's head back in time a couple of centuries to the empire's glory days. It's taken for granted that the Roman Empire of Augustus, Trajan, Hadrian, and Marcus Aurelius was a fundamentally functional state. This is the period that we call the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, and with good reason. While there were occasional civil wars and conflicts with the empire's neighbors, this was mostly a period of peace, population growth, a thriving economy, and a more or less stable political system. It's not that there wasn't war during this period. There were still a few civil wars and numerous conflicts with barbarians and more substantial foreign powers, but the point is, it was far less common than it had been during the bloody days of Caesar, Pompey, and Mark Antony, or than it would become during the crisis of the 3rd century. That contrast is the most important thing. This was the Roman Empire at its height, between the beginning of Augustus's reign, 27 BC, and the death of Marcus Aurelius in 180 AD. The empire stretched from Hadrian's Wall in the north of Britain to the Sahara in the south. The Rhine River was the border with the barbarian world in northern Europe, and so was the Danube, at least in places. The Emperor Trajan had added a couple of provinces in modern-day Romania beyond the Danube, which is mostly why the Romanians speak a Romance language today. Egypt and the entire northern coast of Africa belonged to Rome, and that was the breadbasket that fed the empire's great cities. In the east, it included all of Asia Minor, modern Turkey, along with Judea, Syria, and part of Arabia. The Euphrates River was more or less the eastern boundary. It's impossible to overstate the sheer diversity the empire contained within its borders. Broadly, the eastern part of the Mediterranean spoke Greek, and the western part spoke Latin. But dozens of local languages simultaneously survived and thrived, and not everyone, especially rural people, would have been proficient in one of the two major languages. Many inhabitants of Britain continued to speak British, the forerunner of modern Breton and Welsh. Punic continued to be spoken in North Africa. Greek, Latin, and the Coptic language coexisted in Egypt. Aramaic, Syriac, Hebrew, and other languages competed for space in the Near East. Those are just a few examples, and bilingualism was the norm rather than an exception. If the languages were diverse, so too were the lifestyles. The empire included poor farmers scrabbling to make a living in marshy British fields, itinerant shepherds who drove sheep through the passes of Italy's Apennine Mountains in an annual cycle, middle-class urban merchants who transported bulk goods like pottery from one neighboring coastal city to the next on small ships. Slaves, of course, were ubiquitous and filled a vast array of roles in society. Highly educated Greek slaves were highly sought after as tutors and doctors. At the opposite end of the spectrum, captives taken in war could live a hellish existence with a lifespan of only a couple years as mine slaves or agricultural laborers on huge plantation-style estates. The Roman Empire boasted the most disciplined, most powerful, and most effective army in the known world, maybe even in the history of the world to that point. Mining on an industrial scale in Spain and elsewhere provided the readily available silver that powered a fully monetized and complex economy. Long-distance trade was common, even in inexpensive bulk goods like grain and pottery. Educated people around the empire shared a common culture based on a similar set of common texts and school curricula, whether they grew up in London, in Britain, or Carthage in North Africa, Alexandria in Egypt, or Ephesus in Asia Minor. The Roman Empire was a cosmopolitan, maybe even a global space. Ease of movement and communication defined it. Something like 40% of the population, both free and slave, would move a significant distance over the course of their lives. New ideas, practices, and beliefs traveled just as easily as, and along with, goods and people, and they traveled along the same networks. An aristocrat in Italy might exchange letters with correspondents in Spain, Greece, North Africa, and Gaul, and those letters would travel in the same ships, through the same ports, and along the same roads that carried grain, pottery, slaves, religious practices, and soldiers from place to place. No state would match the infrastructure and engineering of the Roman Empire until the modern era. Prosperous local elites paid for public buildings like baths and arenas in cities small and large across the empire, whether they inscribed the dedications to those things in Greek, Latin, or some other local language. This has to be emphasized. The Roman Empire was in large part an empire of elites, by elites, and for elites. Inequality, as we imagine it, was through the roof. The most powerful families were the equivalent of today's large multinational corporations, with landholdings scattered across the empire and business interests in everything from plantation agriculture to shipping to mining and everything else you can possibly imagine. Even at the local level, aristocrats controlled the vast majority of the land and wealth, and these local elites were the political actors who tied each of these regions together with the imperial center. They were the ones who communicated with the imperial court and who filled the local political offices that would bring them into contact with central authorities. When we talk about provinces becoming Roman after conquest, for example, for the most part, we're talking about how the most important people in recently conquered communities internalized the values of Roman taste and its understanding of power. One of the great paradoxes of the Roman Empire isn't that it fell, but that it lasted so long in the first place, and with so little apparent use of coercive force to keep the provinces in line. It's possible to overstate this acquiescence. Provinces did rebel, and they were brutally put down, most notably Judea on a couple of different occasions. For the most part, though, it's remarkable how few rebellions there actually were. The empire couldn't have afforded to keep a garrison of soldiers in every city, but it didn't have to. It simply wasn't necessary. So why was that? Why were the inhabitants of Rome's provinces so uninterested in armed rebellion? There's one overarching answer, and that's the emperor. The emperor provided a focus for the loyalties of provincials, and an ideology of good government and responsiveness convinced the provincials to buy in. Rome provided an explicitly articulated vision of what it provided to provincials about the rightness of its rule and its effective in governance, an ideology. But what's remarkable is that the provincials bought it, internalized it, and articulated exactly the same sentiments in a variety of contexts over and over and over again. It's not that the emperor and the people who surrounded him just produced a bunch of propaganda about how awesome Rome was, and the provincials bought it like a bunch of rubes who didn't know any better. As the historian Clifford Ando put it in his book, Imperial Ideology and Provincial Loyalty in the Roman Empire, one of my very favorite works of history, quote, "Acquiescence, and ultimately loyalty to Rome, thus required recognition that the Roman construction of society, in relations between provinces, cities, individuals, emperors, and empire, adequately mapped the collective value commitments of its residents." So let's simplify that a little bit. In other words, this ideology only worked because it appealed to the inhabitants of Gaul and Britain and North Africa and Egypt and Syria, because they felt the way that ideology described and ordered that world made sense. Consensus was the goal, and by that I don't mean our English word consensus. Consensus was a technical Latin term that carried with it very specific sets of meanings about the unanimous agreement between rulers and ruled about the nature of their relationship. That agreement really did matter to the Romans, and they constantly sought the explicit public approval of provincials to their rule through a variety of rituals. This is why Christians got into so much trouble and were such easy targets for persecution. That loyalty oath was technically a religious sacrifice to the genius, the spirit of the emperor, and many Christians refused to participate in it as a violation of their beliefs. For obvious reasons, this made Christians suspect to the rest of the upstanding Roman citizens, not to mention magistrates, provincial governors, and of course the emperor himself. The payment of taxes, which took place publicly, was another ritual that expressed explicit approval. Record-taking through the census was another. Participation in the imperial cult, meaning those aforementioned sacrifices to the genius, the guiding spirit of the emperor, was probably the most important. What all of those expressions of loyalty did was create a sense of community around belonging to the Roman Empire. No matter where you lived, no matter what language you spoke when you went to the market to buy grain, no matter what gods you prayed to in the temples in your local community, you always belonged to the broader community of the Roman Empire too. The emperor was the focus for all of these loyalties, and constant communication between the emperor and his subjects was what underpinned the entire system. The Romans advertised the fair rule of law as a justification for their governance, and provincials made use of that offer over and over and over again. There are hundreds of examples of local communities or individuals petitioning the emperor over some local dispute, and it was the emperor's job to answer those petitions quickly and fairly. Even if it were something as seemingly insignificant as a single small farmer being forced off his lands, the petitioner had a right to expect a response. Now, conversely, when the emperor put forth a new law, he sought to communicate that law to even the most far-flung communities. Call and response, response and call. This was the constant rhythm of communication between the emperor and his subjects. Even if the local provincial governor were corrupt or incompetent, and they often were, the underlying idea was that the emperor's subjects could get a fair shake from the emperor himself without fear of reprisal, and that provincials wouldn't be struck blindly by some new law or regulation. The consensus was built on the idea of constant communication, and both parties, the emperor's bureaucracy and the local communities that made up the empire, kept massive records of their every interaction with each other. Now, local elites, whom we discussed before, were the intermediaries between the provincials and the emperor's bureaucracy. They were mostly autonomous and maintained their local superiority by drafting recruits for the army, by keeping the peace, and collecting taxes. They sent regular gifts to the emperor, worked the levers of power at the imperial court through networks of patronage, and in return they received gifts and legitimacy for their local control. In terms of the actual functioning of that government, the emperor was the focus. The Roman Empire was an empire of individual communities, all tied to the emperor himself, not necessarily to each other, like the spokes of a wheel connected to the hub at the center. An imperial bureaucracy to handle all of that constant communication and record-keeping didn't spring into being fully formed. Instead, it grew out of the imperial household. Now, a household, in the sense a Roman aristocrat of the first century BC would have understood it, encompassed far more than a few servants. Functioned more like a multi-pronged business, with dozens or hundreds of slaves and former slaves who worked as secretaries, scribes, legal experts, political fixers, doctors, chefs, and managers of the various economic activities that fell under the control of that aristocrat, including shipping, banking, and of course the ownership of large landed estates. The emperor, at least initially, styled himself as merely the most important of these aristocrats, rather than something entirely different, in the imperial bureaucracy, grew out of this pre-existing structure. Now, as time went on, the imperial household became something very different. Rather than slaves and freedmen, equestrians, extremely wealthy people just a notch below the senatorial elite, came to dominate the bureaucracy, especially those with legal qualifications, by the time of Hadrian, starting in 117. The bureaucracy became, in other words, larger and more professional. It was still remarkably small, though, especially considering the millions of people then living in the Roman Empire. Just a few hundred people gathered around the person of the emperor basically ran the entire thing. Senators, meaning the elite aristocratic members of the Senate, the elected body that had formerly ruled Rome, and equestrians, the second richest class, helped by taking military commands, governing provinces, and filling other roles within the imperial household. So this was the empire at its peak. Not perfect, of course, but governed by consensus between the emperor and the empire's inhabitants. The military was large and effective, the economy was booming by any metric, and its culture flourished. In the 2nd century, a succession of five highly competent emperors, Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, and Marcus Aurelius, ensured the functioning of this system. And it helped that the four of them reigned for a combined 82 years, and that meant stability.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
After the death of Marcus Aurelius in 180, things went badly downhill. Commodus, Marcus Aurelius's son and the villain of the movie Gladiator, was a disaster, and his two successors lasted a total of 6 months. Septimius Severus ruled for 18 years, between 193 AD and 211 AD, and while he was a competent military commander and a generally solid emperor, he inaugurated the financial problems that plagued the empire throughout the 3rd century by debasing the coinage. His successors, his descendants, managed to hold on to power until 235, but they showcased a mixture of bad decision-making, incompetence, and rule by children. When the last of the Severan dynasty was assassinated in 235, it inaugurated a legitimate crisis within the Roman Empire, the first since the Year of Four Emperors in 69 AD. In 238, six different men were recognized as emperor. It would be literally 35 years before a truly competent man held the office again. So what went wrong during this crisis of the 3rd century, as it's commonly known? Well, pretty much everything. At heart was a crisis of imperial legitimacy. Any general with an army, whether that was on the Rhine frontier, the Danube, or in Syria, could declare himself emperor as long as he had the support of his troops. Nothing set one usurper apart from another, aside from military success, and even that only lasted as long as his troops stayed loyal. That loyalty could shift at any moment, and when it did, the so-called emperor wouldn't survive for long. There was even a whole succession of emperors in Gaul who ruled it as an effectively independent territory for 15 years, and a number of the eastern provinces, centered on the oasis trading city of Palmyra, functioned as an independent state for more than a decade. So that's one problem, the problem of constant usurpations and regional fracturing. 20 different men, not counting another 6 unsuccessful usurpers, were recognized as emperor between 235 and 284, and most of them were more concerned with putting out the numerous immediate fires that had cropped up than fixing some of the fundamental political issues this crisis brought to the fore. Of those 20 men, only 3 weren't assassinated. Decius was killed by the Goths, Valerian died a prisoner of the Persians, and Claudius Gothicus died of the plague. The newly empowered and emboldened barbarians, not to mention the resurgent Persians, chipped away at the borders, but this was more a symptom of the empire's problems than a cause. With the armies constantly away from the frontier backing one general or another in a civil war, the borders were undermanned. In the second episode, we discussed the tight connections between the barbarian and the Roman worlds. Goths along the Danube, or Alemanni along the Rhine, noticed when the troops who were supposed to be garrisoning the forts that guarded the limes, the border, were suddenly empty or running with skeleton crews. Being good opportunists, the barbarians took advantage of those gaps to raid into Roman territory. Success begat success, and formerly small-time leaders grew more and more powerful. These leaders were able to consolidate their hold over groups, and significant tribal confederations emerged from a mass of only barely connected barbarian groups. The great barbarian tribes that we encounter a century later, and will continue to encounter as we move through this show, came into being in the context of that Roman instability. Normally, the Romans pursued a policy of divide and conquer beyond the frontier, pitting leaders against each other and subsidizing others while launching raids and occasionally major campaigns whenever one group became a potential threat. But with Roman attention elsewhere for decades, this policy was interrupted. In the absence of direct, consistent Roman intervention, leaders and barbarian groups emerged that were larger and better established than had been the case before. This would have major consequences down the road. It's important to bear this in mind, because one of the major questions about the fall of the Roman Empire is whether it really faced more serious external threats in the 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries, or whether the empire was simply less able to deal with those threats than it had been before. What I'm suggesting here is a combination of the two. The Roman Empire's inability to deal with threats during the 3rd century allowed them to become more powerful when its attention was elsewhere, which made the barbarians, and also the Persians, genuinely more troublesome when the late 4th and 5th centuries came around. While the usurpations, constant civil wars, and barbarian raids get the headline attention, the empire's biggest problems during the crisis of the 3rd century were less sexy and substantially more serious. There was plague at repeated intervals, including a serious epidemic known as the Plague of Cyprian that raged between 250 and 270. This was probably smallpox, a repeat of the Antonine Plague that had troubled the empire during the reign of Marcus Aurelius, but the consequences of hundreds of thousands or millions of deaths from disease were far more serious in an already unstable political situation. That meant that the tax base shrank, agricultural labor was both harder to find and more expensive when it could be found, and military manpower was constantly in short supply. These repeated bouts of plague were a consequence of the basic structure of the empire. Remember, cities, even at great distances, were connected by roads and ports, and if the weather was good, a flare-up of smallpox in Rome could be in Carthage in 5 days, Marseille or Tarragona in a week, Lyon in Gaul and Alexandria in Egypt in 2 weeks, or even Antioch in Syria in 3 weeks. The second problem was financial, and it existed on a couple of different levels. First, the constant usurpations and the regional splitting of the East and Gaul meant that large areas weren't subject to taxation from the central government for years at a time, including some of the richest and most prosperous regions of the empire. Moreover, the plagues, barbarian incursions, and general abandonment of particular areas further reduced the tax base. Second, and more important, Roman currency had been steadily debased, meaning that more base metals were added to the precious metal in the coinage, from the reign of Nero onward. This wasn't a problem to start with, but by the beginning of the 3rd century, the denarius, which had originally been 98% silver during the reign of Augustus, was down to about 50% silver. That process accelerated during the reign of Caracalla, who ruled from 211 to 218, and the argument has been made that rather than just tinkering with the coinage, Caracalla was truly attempting to manipulate it. Caracalla lowered the weight standard of the gold coin, the aureus. He debased the denarius further, and he introduced his own silver coin, the Antoninianus, which he pegged at an artificially high rate. The only solution to make up the budget shortfalls that came along with a shrinking tax base was further debasement of the coinage. Soldiers had to be paid, and if an emperor didn't have the money, the only way to pay them was to create more money. This happened throughout the 3rd century at an ever-increasing rate, but especially between 253 and 260, when the political problems were at their very worst. By the time the Emperor Aurelian came to the throne in 270 and set about repairing the empire, the silver content of the Antoninianus was a pathetic 1.5%. Inflation was completely out of control as a result of the broken confidence in the monetary system, and in many places, the state simply stopped collecting taxes in money and started collecting them in kind. Grain would be taken as tax and then supplied immediately to the army, for example. Aurelian tried to fix this problem once he'd stabilized the empire by finishing off the Gallic and Palmyrene breakaway provinces. He reformed the regional mints that produced money and re-standardized the coinage around an improved silver issue, the Aurelianus. The bad money minted during the 3rd century didn't completely fall out of use, though, and it was replaced by improved coinage at various rates in different places. Inflation was still bad enough that the Emperor Diocletian, 10-15 years later, felt the need to stabilize prices by edict, a bad idea that practically never works. Now, to be clear, not all historians agree that what happened during the 3rd century needs to be considered a crisis. Crisis is a loaded term, and we don't have a lot of written evidence to work with for the period, far less than we do for the 2nd century or the 4th. Much of what we do have are early Christian texts whose perspective is influenced by the massive persecutions of the Emperor Decius in 250, and a strong apocalyptic strain that saw the second coming of Christ just around the corner. Even pagan literary texts from the period, such as those of Herodian and Dio Cassius, are colored by the personal disappointment of their authors. Many of the developments that came to fruition in the 3rd century, such as plague, had their roots in the 2nd century. And while the empire that emerged in the 4th century looked substantially different from that of the 2nd, this line of reasoning goes, it makes more sense to think of the 3rd century not as one of crisis, but of transformation and change. Crisis, if you buy this line of argumentation, implies a value judgment, that what came after was inferior to what came before. I don't think that's the case. Not everything that happened during the 3rd century was bad. Some regions, especially Spain, actually kind of flourished. Still, I'm going to quote the historian J.H. F.W. Liebeschütz, one of my favorites working on this period, because I think he's exactly right. Quote, "The fact remains that the word crisis clearly and compactly sums up a good deal of what happened in the 3rd century. There can surely be no argument that in the 3rd century, the Roman Empire faced situations of danger, emergency, and disaster extremely frequently. For the first time in its existence, it had to fight major wars on its eastern and western frontiers at the same time. There was an endless succession of usurpations. For some time, it looked as though Gaul and the eastern provinces might break away into separate empires. There was serious inflation. The huge rise in prices following Aurelian's coinage reforms can hardly be described as anything other than a currency crisis. There were outbreaks of plague." He goes on to say, "Indeed, the entire period from the murder of Alexander Severus to the rise of Constantine might be treated as a single, sustained crisis of the imperial office. It is, in fact, difficult to avoid using the term." End quote. This seems to me to be exactly right. Historians have chipped away at the view that everything that happened during the 3rd century was a disaster. Even runaway inflation, for example, might have helped to monetize certain out-of-the-way parts of the Roman world that had previously relied on trade in kind. Certain regions did quite well despite the political and monetary troubles, including North Africa, Egypt, and, as I mentioned, Spain. Still, try telling a Latin-speaking farmer or a small-town merchant in Dacia, the Roman province beyond the Danube in present-day Romania, that the 3rd century wasn't a disaster. Barbarians repeatedly raided and invaded, and Roman troops were constantly withdrawn from the region to fight in civil wars. By 274, the Roman military had completely abandoned most of its posts beyond the river. That rural farmer or town-dwelling merchant could either move south of the Danube, leave his home, or try his hand at living in a world much different than the Roman Empire, a world where towns and urban infrastructure quickly disappeared and the authorities weren't Roman, but barbarian. Or what about the tenant farmer in Spain, without land of his own, who wanted to pull up stakes and find better paying work with another landlord. Increasingly restrictive laws, a result of the population decline and tighter labor market, prohibited him from moving. For that person and his family, the third century absolutely made his life worse.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With all of that said, the Roman Empire that emerged from the crisis of the 3rd century wasn't a dying state. It was different, for sure, from what had existed at the end of the reign of Marcus Aurelius in 180, but it had achieved a semblance of stability. How? Well, Aurelian's reform of the currency helped, but under the reign of Diocletian, more on him later, who ruled between 284 and 305, there was a fundamental reform of the entire system of governance. The provinces were reorganized and increased in number, so governors handled smaller geographic units. These provinces were then grouped into larger units called dioceses, each of which had its own vicarius, or ruling official. Each vicarius then had his own staff of bureaucrats. The rise of bureaucracy is one of the fundamental facets of this later Roman Empire. The remarkable thing about the system I outlined for the earlier empire, between the provinces and the emperor, this system based on consensus, was how few permanently employed people it took to run it. There were maybe a few hundred actual bureaucrats in the imperial household, and they mostly handled legal cases, correspondence, and record keeping. Members of the Senate or the Equestrian Order, private individuals, some of the wealthiest and most powerful aristocrats in the empire, shuttled between governing provinces and holding military commands, and they brought along their own households to handle the minutiae of doing those things. They weren't bureaucrats or even really government employees in the way that we'd understand it. The actual business of tax collection and legal work in the vast majority of the empire was handled by local elites who effectively worked as the intermediaries between that tiny imperial household and their own cities and rural regions. That's why, earlier in this episode, I said that the empire was by and for those elites. It was founded and functioned on the connection, both cultural and political, between the institution of the imperial household and the important people in the localities that made up the empire. And they showed their importance by building things for their local communities, like theaters, arenas, bathhouses, and other public buildings. That connection grew less important in the later empire. The extent and meaning of this bureaucratization has been endlessly debated among historians, but the fact of the change is undisputed. As the historian Averil Cameron put it, quote, "The 4th century witnessed the transformation of the old orders, still closely linked by birth and wealth, into a service aristocracy in which rank depended on office." This created a new aristocracy and a complex gradation of ranks, including the illustres, spectabiles, gloriosi, and clarissimi, a range of titles whose meaning mattered a great deal to the initiated. These new bureaucratic roles carried with them authority, status, and wealth, both in direct payment and corruption. And these bureaucrats existed in huge numbers. In place of the few hundred actual imperial employees in the 1st or 2nd century, there were perhaps 25 or 35,000 imperial bureaucrats by the middle of the 4th century. In the year 150, for example, a resident of Marseille or Carthage or Athens might go her entire life without ever meeting or even seeing someone directly employed by the state, except maybe a soldier. You paid your taxes to the same local landholders and magistrates who endowed your city with its bath complexes and its statues, whose slaves you did business with, and who made public speeches on the occasion of religious festivals. In the year 350, by contrast, a resident of one of those cities would be in constant contact with representatives of the state. New buildings, if there were any, were largely paid for by the central government rather than local officials. Administrators working under the provincial governor collected the taxes, and those administrators used the wealth they garnered from their positions to make themselves locally important, rather than vice versa. This is why historians have tended to label the later Roman Empire an authoritarian or autocratic state. The emperor was no longer the princeps, merely the first, most important citizen among many. Instead, he was the dominus, the lord. Even if that whole first citizen thing had been pure fiction, it was a fiction people felt compelled to respect and reinforce for centuries. Fiction's important. It's a lie mutually agreed upon, even consciously, that still has tremendous power to influence behavior and how we think of the world. After Aurelian, and especially Diocletian, that fiction disappeared, and it marked a fundamental shift in the conceptual relationship between the emperor and his subjects. Local elites working hand in hand with a small imperial court produced consensus. The later empire's bureaucrats and emperors demanded submission and obedience. Now, to be clear, a lot of that had to do with the fundamental weakness of the imperial center in the 3rd century. Local elites were less willing to buy in consensually to what seemed to be a constant morass of chaos and rapid turnover. Why collect taxes for an emperor who probably wouldn't be on the throne in a year? Why go to the trouble of collecting supplies or recruits for an army that would leave its frontier posts whenever its commanding general caught some imperial ambitions? The growth of bureaucracy and a more authoritarian approach was gradual, not overnight, and to some extent it was a rational response to an understandably less invested provincial elite. Now, this is all something of an oversimplification, but it captures the fundamental shift that took place between the 2nd century and the 4th. The fact that these bureaucrats had special access to stable gold coinage, as opposed to the unstable silver coinage that still circulated, made them even wealthier than they would have been otherwise. These imperial officials then invested that wealth in large agricultural estates, and at least in Egypt, if not elsewhere, they oriented the produce of those estates toward the market economy. This has to be emphasized. After the serious downturns of the 3rd century, the Roman economy in general rebounded in the 4th. Throughout Britain and Spain, the mining capitals of the western part of the empire, metal extraction nearly shut down throughout the 3rd century. It came back in the 4th century, though on a smaller scale, before again declining in the 5th. Pottery exports from North Africa, the center of production in the entire empire, peaked during the 2nd century. They dropped dramatically in the 3rd before roaring back in the 4th century. So what lay behind this recovery from the crisis of the 3rd century? More than anything else, it was the fact that competent men held the imperial office for pretty much the entirety of the 4th century. As Guy Housel put it, quote, between 284 and 395, the empire was governed by what have been termed problem-solving emperors. He goes on to say, quote, a case can be made that the reigns of the emperors from Diocletian to Theodosius I, again from 284 to 395, represents the high point of Roman imperial rule, a long sequence of consistently able rulers. The restoration that began under Aurelian in the 270s, with his reform of the coinage and his crushing of the breakaway Gallic and Palmyrene empires, really took shape with the reign of Diocletian between 284 and 305. Diocletian was a soldier emperor, a native of the Balkans, a region that had for a long time produced the real meat of the officer class of the army. Nobody better embodied the newly authoritarian spirit of the later empire better than Diocletian. Diocletian has been lauded as heralding the new restoration after the chaos of the 3rd century crisis. Here's a typical formulation of that traditionalist point of view from the historian Alan Bowman, one of my favorites, in the Cambridge Ancient History. Quote, the 2 decades of Diocletian's reign saw, on the traditional view, the reestablishment of political, military, and economic stability after a half century of chaos at the price of a more absolutist monarchy, a greatly expanded, and therefore greedier and more expensive army and bureaucracy, and a more oppressive tax regime, end quote. Whether Diocletian did all this with a master plan in mind, or simply as a series of ad hoc solutions to pressing problems, is up for debate. Diocletian reformed the coinage in the army, rebuilt the administration, and launched a massive persecution of Christians, but he's best known for what's called the Tetrarchy. Immediately after becoming emperor, Diocletian appointed a colleague named Maximian to be the second emperor, who was undeniably junior, but trustworthy enough to handle problems in Diocletian's absence. A few years later, in 293, Diocletian and Maximian appointed a pair of junior emperors, Constantius and Galerius. Four emperors, hence tetrarchy. The idea here was that the problems of the empire required an imperial college, not a single emperor, to handle everything that came up. The subordinate-superior relationship wasn't intended to last forever. Eventually, the two senior emperors would retire voluntarily into private life, their juniors would take their place, and then two new junior emperors would be appointed, and so on and so forth. This was a rational response to the problems of the 3rd century. Anybody with an army was a potential usurper, so if you had to fight multiple wars or you had multiple problems to solve, you might as well make the person you send to solve those problems an emperor in his own right. This system broke down almost immediately, though, and civil wars racked the empire for a couple of decades. Constantine, the best-known and most celebrated emperor of this later period, emerged victorious from them. He officially adopted Christianity, founded Constantinople, and was one of only two emperors in the 4th century to rule the entirety of the empire. He was the last one to do it without significant challenges to his rule or having large bits of territory slipping from the grasp of the central government. Constantine's descendants ruled the empire for another 25 years after his death, and there was only a brief civil war before Valentinian emerged in 364 as a dominant, competent emperor. The emperors of the 4th century were, like those of the 3rd century, largely military emperors. The center of power shifted away from the center of the empire, especially from Rome, and toward the frontiers, where the army was stationed. The city of Trier in Gaul, and Sirmium in Pannonia, today's Serbia, were the beneficiaries of this. They experienced a wave of huge building projects and effectively became capitals in their own right. Emperors were rarely, if ever, in Italy anymore. They were constantly among soldiers, surrounded by their troops, and they didn't go on public tours the way that Trajan, Hadrian, and Marcus Aurelius had. They were increasingly inaccessible to all but their highest military officials and civilian bureaucrats. Over the course of the 4th century, the Roman Empire became a Christian empire. There had been Christians within the empire before, of course, and there were still a great many pagans. The empire's Christians weren't united, but belonged to a number of different competing subgroups. But there had been only one short-lived pagan emperor since Constantine, and really there was no going back to the previous state of affairs. Emperors often got involved in church disputes, and state funds went toward the construction of churches and other religious buildings. Bishops played an increasingly active role in both the lives of the cities and the broader political scene, even at the imperial court. So let's stop here and take stock of where the empire stood on the eve of the Goths' crossing of the Danube in 376. Was it a fundamentally healthy, functional state? Or was it a disaster waiting to happen? Well, I'd say it was a little of both. The system that emerged from the 3rd century crisis was functional, even if it differed drastically from what had existed in the 2nd century at the height of the Pax Romana. The bureaucracy was much larger, more forceful, and more intrusive than the alliance between a small imperial household and local elites had been in the first couple of centuries of the empire. But then, it had to be. The economy was once again thriving after a rough 3rd century, though it was diminished in scale compared to the 2nd century. But that diminishment of scale had more to do with a smaller population than anything else. The army was probably larger than it had ever been, though as we discussed, it also faced more serious threats on the frontiers. At the heart of all this is whether the political system was stable. The administrative reforms of Diocletian, like reorganizing the provinces, had helped for sure. The emperors spent more time on the frontiers directly dealing with problems, which led to fewer usurpations than had been the case in the 3rd century. That issue of imperial legitimacy still existed, though, and the 4th century still had drastically more civil wars than the 1st or the 2nd. In fact, practically every emperor in the 4th century had to deal with at least one usurper or fought a full-on war against a rival imperial colleague. Even Constantine only ruled alone for the last decade or so of his reign. Practically speaking, this means that the empire never truly recovered from the crisis of imperial legitimacy that cropped up in the 3rd century. Once the cat was out of the bag, any ambitious general with enough support could make a go at being emperor. The difference between the relatively stable 4th century and the 3rd was, in large part, the quality of men who held the imperial office. Even the Emperor Valens, who died fighting at Adrianople against the Goths, whom I called incompetent in an earlier episode of this show, was practically Superman in comparison to the worthless emperors of the 5th century. Valens was only incompetent in comparison to men like his brother Valentinian, Constantine the Great, or Theodosius. And that's the core of the issue here. The system that emerged in the 4th century was stable and viable, even with usurpations and civil wars, as long as the emperor was himself competent. Remember, it was much more difficult to devolve authority, to hand off responsibilities, especially military ones, to subordinates if you were afraid that subordinate might take the opportunity to declare himself emperor. That put more pressure on the emperor himself to be competent, especially as a military commander. He had to spend time among the armies, he had to hang out on the frontiers, and he had to personally oversee as much of the bureaucracy as possible. If the emperor could handle all those responsibilities, and if the emperor was suspicious enough, violent enough, and decisive enough to execute anybody who might have been conspiring against him, the system could function just fine indefinitely. Like Guy Housel pointed out, that was the case for almost the entire 4th century. Diocletian, Constantine, Valentinian, and Theodosius were all among the best and most competent emperors in the history of the empire, and with them in charge, it worked all right. Theodosius, the last man to rule both the eastern and the western halves of the empire, and who did so competently, died in 395. It's not a coincidence that everything went to hell in a handbasket afterward. He was replaced by his sons Honorius and Arcadius, the former 10 years old and the latter 18. The system couldn't function properly with child emperors or incompetent adult emperors, and that's exactly what we see in the 5th century. So that's our verdict. The later Roman Empire was both stable and unstable, viable and unviable, depending on who was in charge. In the next episode of The Fall of Rome, we'll return to something I mentioned in the first episode of the show, the necessity of taking a regional point of view to understand these long, complex processes of change over time. The Roman Empire was a unified empire, to be sure, but it was also a collection of distinct regions, and each of those regions experienced the end of the empire differently. Some suffered heavily and went quickly, while in others you might not have known anything was really wrong even in the year 500. The first of our areas of investigation would be Britain, the most extreme example of rapid and real decline. We'll talk about Angles, Saxons, Jutes, genetics, a whole bunch of archaeology, and even the legend of King Arthur. Thank you for joining me for today's episode. If you have a spare moment, I'd appreciate it if you left a rating and a review. You can follow me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA. And if you have questions, comments, or concerns, or if you just want to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire, drop me a line. Until next time, thanks for listening.